Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Please try to silence your cell phones if you could. Time is 1 minute to 9 o'clock. We'll try to start on time. We're a little early with enthusiasm today. January 18th, 2023. I'm joined today by the new Finance Committee. We have Senator Hoffman, who served as co-chair with a capital budget. We'll have Senator Olson, co-chair, dealing with all legislation. We have Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, who's new to the committee, not new to finance. She comes over from the other body. We have Senator Keel, new to the finance committee as a senator, an old hat at the Finance Committee, many years as a Finance Committee aide. And we have Senator Wilson that spent several years here at the committee. Also, Senator Bishop is a past chair. Senator Merrick is also a past chair down the hall. So we have a very, and myself, Senator Stedman, that's been here not quite as long as Senator Hoffman or Senator Olson, but I'm hot on their tail. So we're going to start this year with the normal process. We're going to start this meeting today. We're going to kind of run through the staffing and some introductory stuff. And for those watching or curious at home, we're going to start the next several days with overviews and some background information, setting the stage for upcoming meetings here at the table when we try to work through the revenue and expenditures of the state. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and start with the finance staff. And just as a quick note, each member has staff assigned to them as their committee aide. They sit behind the individual senators, and there's no talking and communicating with your aides other than notes, including if you're the co-chair. They're a motley crew. But anyway, each member has aides. And for those in the building that have questions, other aides, senator aides, they're certainly encouraged and welcome to speak with the Finance Committee aides on Finance Committee questions or other things, or with the senators, with the senators. So that's kind of the structure overall. But the Finance Committee staff, I'll start with the Operating Budget Coordinator, Mr. Pete Eklund. He's probably behind me. Yep. Mr. Eklund has done many years as Operating Budget Chairman, has a lot of experience. He's the lead person. So all committee aides, if they have questions dealing with the operating budget, we want to kind of channel him through the coordinator. He'll also lead the operating budget committee staff meetings that go on once a week normally. Then we have Amanda Ryder, who is presently not in the room. She has many years as a finance committee aide, also in Ledge Finance. David Scott, he works with the committee scheduling. And he's also the Finance Committee aide. He's behind me, right by the door. So scheduling questions could be directed to Mr. Scott. Rose Foley, she's the Finance Committee aide in my office also, and she is to my right. Rose has been around many years around the Finance Committee. I think she started quite a while ago. I remember just young gal, looked like she's almost out of high school. So she's been around and has lots of years of experience, not only working with agencies, but with Finance Committee members. The last member she worked with was Senator Von Imhoff. And then with that, I'd like to go ahead and go to Senator Hoffman, if he can introduce his Finance Committee staff, and I'll go around the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two members, my chief of staff that's been with me for a couple of decades, Mr. Tim Grusendorf, and I also have working on budget items, Meriden Borio, they're directly behind me. So if they have any questions regarding the capital budget or any other items, they can be addressed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm honored to go ahead and have my chief of staff here in the committee room as well, and that's Kelly Good, and she's been on finance with the former Senate President in the past, has just come over from the administration. And I also have Ken Alpers, who's behind me. He comes over from the Department of Revenue under the Walker administration. We're real familiar with some of the budgets that are here. Also in the gallery, I have Brix Hahn, who has been with me for years, as well as Katie McCall, who is going to be assisting us with the administration
as well. Let's remember to try to speak into the mic so we get good recordings.
Okay.
And then just signal me if the recording volume drops, and I'll try to help with that.
That's it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Bishop.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Behind me, I have Cody Grusendorf, my finance aide, and Ms. Ann Richter's finance aide, and Top Shelf, both employees. Thank you.
And Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Behind me, I have my trustee finance staff, Mr. Gary Zett, who has been with the state service for many, many years. He didn't want to tell me how many years, but I believe this is his 505th moon he is starting with the state service.
And Gary, could you put your hand up a little bit so the people at home know who they're referring to? Yeah, just to help people with the faces, with the names, if they don't recognize you. We'll go then to Senator Merrick.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to introduce Jamie Jones, my finance staff behind me, and she was staff last year in the other body, so we're pleased to be here. Thank you.
So you're bringing also experienced staff to the table.
Correct. Thank you, sir.
And Senator Keel.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to have sitting behind me Kathy Schlinghide. This is her first 2 years as a finance aide. She has, however, worked in my office 4 full years. Before that, she worked for a member of the other body from your district for a couple of years. And while she's new to the finance table, she's got a chemistry degree, a law degree, and she'll be running circles around all of us in half a minute.
Okay, that sounds good. Now we have a finance committee secretaries, Ms. Donnie Gott. She's there. She's been here many years. Allison Wade is there. Marta Lastufka. Did I get it right? Just for background, I've introduced her 6 times at the beginning of 6 different legislatures. This is the first time I actually pronounced it correctly. So I'm very proud of today and the way the meeting's going. And Laura Housley, which one? Correct that. Hosey, excuse me, Hosey, and I should remember that Hosey because we had a neighbor Hosey when I was a little boy, or my mom was a little girl, I should say, in Petersburg. And then we'll go to the LIO Information Office staff, Jake Wade. So that's the crew that'll be working here for the next 2 years. We're going to be very busy. We'll might run morning and afternoon meetings on occasions, but we'll work with the committee members' schedule, and depending on the other body and the sequencing of our budgets, how we roll along. Let me go over a little bit of decorum. What we want to do is always have a good, fair exchange of information and an openness to all information to all members and aides and, frankly, throughout the building. There might be more information than members or aides would like, but that would be preferred rather than having information strangled or siloed. So we don't operate like that. All members will have equal time expressing their concerns, questions at the table. When there is multiple questions. You may only get a question and a follow-up, and we'll go on to your other colleagues, and we'll come back to you at the end to make sure your questions are asked and answered. And if the presenters don't have the answers, they're more than welcome to get back to the committee. We don't expect presenters to be able to answer every question from all seven of us when they don't even know what questions we're going to ask them. So we will give them the flexibility to punt and come back to us. We would prefer, the three co-chairs would prefer that we don't eat in the room. If you're hungry, you can go down to the lounge. If you're an elected official, back to your office or wherever. But this isn't the dining room. This is the Senate Finance Committee room. There will be, on occasions, iPads at the table. We prefer that they concentrate on the business in front of the committee at the time and try to minimize cell phone use. I know it's very difficult to not pull out your cell phone in the meeting when somebody's sending you a text or whatever, but try to minimize that. And remember to be respectful to the presenter. A lot of the presenters will come before this committee, and it is a very big issue for them. A lot of them are not as comfortable as we are in the room, and we need to treat them with respect, and particularly the general public when they come in, and that we actually, you know, we're not reading the newspaper, we're listening to what they have to say. And if you are uncomfortable with that, you can always, you know, take a personal at ease, run back to your office, whatever you want to do. But we want to just treat all of the presenters with respect. So there will be no reading of newspapers and magazines and things like that here at the table. And your cell phone, if you get a cell phone call, I guess please don't take it in the room if you have to answer that. We're going to work on a little bit more decorum stuff, and we'll send that out a little later after the three of us sit down and have some conversations, but I don't think it'll be much different than before. We want to run professional meetings. We want to start on time and be respectful to everybody, end on time. And if there's ever a question or concern on anything, just ask for an at ease. We will stop the meeting, take a brief at ease, address the issue. That's not a problem. The only time that would not happen is if that request was put at the table as a tactical delay mechanism for some political purpose. Then the chairman would probably be hesitant to do that. But other than that, we have no problem taking an at ease if there's confusion or a misunderstanding or what have you. We have ample time to thoroughly discuss our items in a businesslike fashion and vote any way we want to vote on any issue we want to vote on. So with that, I'd like to start the year with a production forecast from the Department of Natural Resources, and have the commissioner designee, John Boyle, come forward. He will have a couple of his aides, I think, that he may want to bring up. I'll let him introduce them and what they do after he introduces himself. And we'll go through his presentation. Please allow, and this will be the standard process when we have presenters, we'll let them do their slide. We'll ask questions at the end of the slide, and there may be occasions when a presenter might want to deliver multiple slides, and then we'll stop for questions. Because what we want the presenters to do is present their information, get their message on the table, so then we can ask questions and discuss it. With that, Mr. Boyle, you've been here before under a previous employer, so maybe you could give us your background a little bit also. As you'll be, I'm sure, looking to and looking for support for committee members for dropping the designee as commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Co-Chair Hoffman and Co-Chair Olson, honorable members of the Finance Committee. I can tell you that this table looks a lot bigger when you're sitting on this end. So it's a privilege and an honor to be in front of you this morning. My name is John Boyle. I am the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources. And it's, you know, I've been privileged to have a rich opportunity ever since I came to the state. You know, I have to wear that badge of shame that I wasn't born here, but I got here as soon as I could. My career brought me to Alaska actually when I was offered a clerkship with a judge in Fairbanks and had the opportunity of living in the Golden Heart City for a year and a half as I clerked for a number of judges there. And then I had the wonderful opportunity to be offered a job with the North Slope Borough, first as an assistant borough attorney and then later on in life as chief advisor to the mayor and director of the borough's government affairs department. And that in and of itself was an incredible experience, getting to work with the people of the North Slope, whom I love and who it was a real honor to serve. And it really gave me my first insights into the industry, to the oil industry, particularly on the North Slope, and the importance that it played in providing essential services and support for the people that lived in that region, of course, for the state at large. And following that opportunity, I was offered a position at BP, where I served as their director of government affairs for 3 years, and you know, continued learning more about the oil and gas industry, in particular from the perspective of what was then a major producer in one of our legacy fields on the North Slope. And then most recently, I've had the opportunity to work for Santos, which is a new entrant to the state. And, you know, that experience was also enlightening to see the challenges that new companies face, new entrants, as they come to Alaska and they, you know, endeavor to invest capital and bring an oil field into development. So a greenfield project, as it's referred to in the industry parlance. So, you know, all of these experiences have helped kind of shape, you know, my perspective on resources. And of course, as you know, DNR has an incredible remit, and it's, you know, the metaphor of the fire hose, I think, is quite apropos, as I've been, you know, learning everything from agriculture to forestry and fire protection and minerals mapping and so on and so forth. So it's an honor, and it's very humbling actually to have this opportunity to serve in this capacity. But you know, really the great privilege in all of this is that we have an incredible team at DNR. I mean, we really have a crew of top-notch professionals that, you know, I think any Fortune 500 company or any entity would want to attract to its ranks. So it's really, we've got a great team. These are consummate professionals that serve with distinction and aplomb. And I think that as you'll see as we present this report, they take great pride in trying to compile this information for the state to help you as legislators, as decision makers, to have the information that you need, of course, to make the very important and consequential decisions that are so vital for the, you know, well-being of all of us that live here in the state. And so if I can, I'll just offer a couple of highlights for this report. And, you know, one of the good news stories here is, as you'll see, is that, you know, generally production on the North Slope has been stable, which when you consider that these are legacy fields that are, you know, pushing 50 years old, where every additional molecule of resource requires, you know, just that much more energy and input in order to extract it, keeping that production level steady in and of itself, I think, reflects a major accomplishment for the producers that are working to, you know, keep oil flowing down our pipeline and, of course, to keep, you know, that revenue stream going for the state. And as a result of that, as you'll see, that, you know, really as we look ahead over the next decade, you know, we forecast generally a very steady trend of production that gradually looks like it increases as we look ahead to the future development of some of these new exciting projects that my team will talk about. So I think, you know, as legislators, as decision makers, it should, at least it helps fill you with a little more confidence that, you know, we have this resource base that looks to be steady, and that, you know, it will bridge us over into the future, I think, to when we might have even more opportunities to monetize some of the other states' resources. So with that, I'll introduce our team. With us, you know, here we have John Crowther, who's the deputy commissioner, who has oversight authority over the Division of Oil and Gas, the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveying, and the Office of Project Management and Permitting. And he's a phenomenal hand that has been with the department now for a number of years. To my far left is Derek Nottingham. He's our director of the Division of Oil and Gas and comes to us with years of industry experience and great insight. And Travis Peltier, who is our petroleum reservoir engineer, be leading the discussion today, also comes to us with extensive experience in the industry. And we have great confidence in their abilities to help us have confidence that these forecasts are accurate and that the data is well analyzed. And then lastly, I'd like to introduce Joe Burns, whom many of you know, has served with distinction in the other body and in this body, and he will be serving as our legislative liaison for this session. So with your permission, Mr. Chair, I will turn things over to Travis Peltier so he can share our production forecast with your committee.
Okay. Mr. Peltier, go ahead.
Thank you, Commissioner. For the record, my name is Travis Peltier. I'm a petroleum reservoir engineer with the Resource Evaluation Section of the Division of Oil and Gas within the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Today, we're going to be talking about Alaska's oil production forecast for the next decade. For your awareness, the Department of Natural Resources has been performing this analysis since 2016. The goal for today is to share the oil production results of fiscal year 2022 and then share the oil forecast for the next 10 years, including methodology and background and how this forecast is generated. Thank you. For the record, I meant to introduce myself and my background a little more, so I can go back to that. Yes. That'll be okay. Thank you.
Please.
So as an industry, from my industry experience, I graduated out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks with a mechanical engineering degree in 2006. I've been staying in the state ever since. I ended up getting a job with BP, working predominantly Prudhoe Bay. I ended up working at one point in time in my 14 years with BP, all of their North Slope assets, including the assets they did not operate. After that, you know, I spent a little time, early 2020, away from the industry for a bit when BP left the state. And then in 2021, in June, I ended up getting a position as the petroleum reservoir engineer for the Division of Oil and Gas within the Resource Evaluation Section. And this year, I was blessed to be given the opportunity to lead the production forecast. Through the chair, Senator Olson, you may remember we were neighbors once upon a time, too, so if I look familiar. So that's a brief introduction. Otherwise, I've spent the majority of my life in the state of Alaska and very happy to be here. So just to brief everyone on the agenda for today, I've already covered the introduction for myself, and Commissioner Boyle has covered the introduction for the team that's up here. The rest of the information I want to cover on background before we talk about the production forecast itself is, again, the fiscal year 2022 in a review, both for Alaska's North Slope and the Cook Inlet basins. And then after that, we're going to talk about the forecasting approach, the methodology that we use to create this forecast. After that, we'll actually go into the fall 2022 forecasting results and then share a summary. Please ask any questions that you have along the way, and I will address them as best as I can. So, again, fiscal year 2022, we're going to have three slides here. The first two will focus on Alaska's North Slope, and the third slide will be on the Cook Inlet. So I'm going to orient first, I guess, a couple of highlights for fiscal year 2022. What I wanted to highlight here was how did 2022 shape up compared to 2021? And again, just these are actual numbers. These are actual production data. So there's no forecasting in any of this yet. The one thing that we've made a change on from previous years, you might notice, is that we have actually split up, instead of showing fields individually, we wanted to have consistency with what you're going to see within the Department of Revenue's presentation later on this week. And so we're presenting these as production areas rather than fields, which has been done in the past. Also, for consistency purposes, the numbers that you'll see up here are also consistent with what's in the RSV. You may remember in years past, there's been some slight disagreements on when we...
We try not to use acronyms because the poor folks at home won't understand what we're talking about, and some of us might even get confused.
Thank you, Senator. So the Department of Revenue's Revenue Sources Book is the publication for the official forecast for both revenue and oil production. And so we wanted to make sure that the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources shared with this committee the exact same set of numbers, whereas in years past there has been some discrepancy. So we wanted to resolve that before coming here. So the numbers and the categories that you'll see for production will reflect that. Okay. Thank you. All right, so what I'm going to do then, if there's no other questions, is just kind of hit the two highlights, and then I'm going to orient everyone to the way the charts are laid out. After that, I'm going to talk about the decreases and increases focused on a chart, but the words will reflect the chart data that we go through it. So again, all these production areas, year on year for the oil field, we expect to see some production decline. As Commissioner Boyle had mentioned, you know, a lot of these fields have been in operation for 50 years, so that's kind of natural to see production decline year on year. Compared to fiscal year 2021 and fiscal year 2022, the North Slope did see a roughly 2% production decrease. That was about 9,570 barrels of oil per day decrease for the fiscal year. And just for a reminder, the fiscal year goes from July 1st to June 30th of the following year. So we don't follow a calendar year here. It's a six-month offset within the year. I'm going to orient everyone to the chart now. The top right chart is on the North Slope daily oil production from the fiscal years of 2016 through 2022. The axis on the y-axis is for your fiscal year annual average daily oil production in terms of barrels of oil per day. So you can see the scale goes from 0 to 600,000 barrels of oil per day. Within this chart, we saw that 2017 was the highest year of production at 526,000 barrels of oil per day and change on average, slightly declining through time. You'll see there's a low point in 2020, which was also, you know, the fiscal year affected by COVID shutdowns of some oil fields on the North Slope. We have a relatively low production period. After that, it does recover in fiscal year 2021. And then you could say back to kind of normal operations post-pandemic, we do see a decline in fiscal year 2022 to last year's production of 476,490 barrels on average. The graph below that, now we have the individual production area changes. Again, the chart on this is a little different on the scale. This is average yearly production change now, also in barrels of oil per day with the zero line hashed so that we can kind of get a sense of what increased and what decreased. So for Prudhoe Bay and the Prudhoe Bay unit satellites, we do see some what I would call flat-ish production for Prudhoe Bay to increasing production. And it has to do with the operator's continued development of the Prudhoe Bay field. You may remember that in 2019, BP Alaska decided to sell the asset to Hilcorp. So Hilcorp is predominantly the operator for these fields. And we see continued drilling in places such as Milne Point, which is by definition part of the PBU satellites for the Department of Revenue's Revenue Sources Book. And those production increases are reflected there. So, you know, continued steady operation of the facilities, along with continued investment for drilling and whatnot. GPMA is also a what I would term a satellite for Prudhoe Bay. And there is some production decline there, but I would call that normal reservoir decline year on year. Within the Kuparuk and the Kuparuk satellites, you'll see a relatively large production increase from the previous fiscal year. And so this is going to be one of the bullet points as well. So I'm going to read the bullet point as well for the Kuparuk and Kuparuk satellites. What you see is natural decline combined with the cessation of natural gas liquids, or NGL imports, that was used for enhanced oil recovery, or EOR. What ended up happening was we have the OPL, or the Ilik Tok pipeline, was being used to transport natural gas liquids from the Prudhoe Bay unit to the Kuparuk River unit for this enhanced oil recovery, but the Kuparuk River unit needed fuel gas to power its facilities. So that pipeline was converted to fuel gas use. The Kuparuk River unit could continue to operate its base oil production. That came at the cost of the enhanced oil recovery activities going on there. So when we see those production declines at the Kuparuk and the Kuparuk satellites, that production decline is predominantly due to the cessation of that activity combined with natural reservoir decline. The next production area was Endicott, and which we see there for that small decline is natural reservoir decline. And then the next big one we see, the next large tranche, is from the Alpine area. Alpine does include the Colville River unit. And what we see for Alpine, and I'm going to go back to the bullet points for this as well, it's the top bullet point under decrease. This production area was actually shut in during the COVID period, so the pandemic era. It was brought back on in fiscal year 2021. And we saw a relatively large production increase after that short shut-in period from fiscal year 2020. So that we term flush production worked its way through the system in fiscal year 2021, and then we saw that reservoir decline come again in fiscal year 2022. That combined with limited drilling for the fiscal year 2022 compared to previous years to lead to the relatively large production decline out of the Alpine production area. Offshore is a number of different offshore fields. However, that was also natural reservoir decline. Nothing of note to point out there. And then we have a couple of increases on the end here. So the NPRA, the National Petroleum Reserve A, which includes the Greater Moose's Tooth Unit. You may recall last year there was a project to develop a new pad out there called GMT-2. That pad was brought online at the very end of I think last November of 2021. And that's been performing well, and that's actually one of the predominant reasons for that production increase out of the NPRA production area. The last production area is the Point Thompson unit. And the Point Thompson unit is predominantly driven by Point Thompson, the initial production system. That started in April of 2016. That was a brand new facility to the slope, very low serial number design. Had a lot of production issues for the first few years of operation. Exxon was the operator two fiscal years ago, and they figured out a lot of the issues to get the facility running better to increase production through the system. Hillcorp has taken over operatorship and has continued that trend of continued facility uptime. So that gets our total Alaska North Slope decrease of about 9,570 barrels fiscal year to fiscal year.
That's true.
That completes this slide?
Yes.
So this is kind of going by memory, but several years ago, the production facilities were all running at the max, as I recall, handling gas or water. And Alpine was the only one with extra capacity. So what is the status of the facilities and handling and cycling gas and water? And maybe when you answer the question, put a little definition on what that is and where they are for those at home.
Okay. Senator Stedman, are you curious about Alpine specifically or all of the facilities on the North Slope?
It's a broad general question. You know, you could get back to us on each facility if you'd like, but just because you can only handle so much water or so much gas, and that limits the amount of production you get. And to increase production, you've got to be able to handle or deal with that issue. So the question is kind of the background of what that issue is and then where are we currently with it.
For the record, Travis Peltier. Senator, yes, you were correct. We can get back to you on specifics if you'd like to know about individual facilities. So I'll tell you some broadly guidelines, what you see at places like Prudhoe Bay, specifically where I have a lot of experience. The majority of the time, your facilities are on those aging assets are going to be limited by their water handling capacity, so how much fluid, when we produce oil out of the ground, it comes with gas and it comes with water. And you have to separate all of those phases of fluid to get to saleable oil at some point in time. For the water and the gas at a lot of the facilities, yes, you are either water handling limited or gas handling limited. And that actually is your limit on your throughput. For some facilities like Point Thompson, right, that'd be a good example, your ability to produce additional condensate, comes with a gas limit. Prudhoe Bay does have various facilities, some are water limited, some are gas limited. Some you consider both water and gas. Within places on the west for the Caparra Ravine and Alpine, I'd have to get back to you on that. So
it's a limiting factor, and we could put a better definition on the facilities and get an idea, because we're going to get into, I think, increase in production coming from our existing fields. So maybe in your presentation you can try to address the processing facilities and those potential increases.
Yes, sir.
Question from Senator Keel and Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Easy question. I need just a little more help understanding the chart. The bottom right, your narration matched the color of the bars in terms of what was increased or decreased. Teach me to square that with the vertical height on the y-axis. It looks like you have decreases showing increased annual production, which seems dissonant to me.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Keel. So yes, please correct me if I get this incorrectly. The increases are listed in blue, so what you see on the numbers over that line is that increase relative to the previous axis, and then this waterfall chart builds off of the previous data point. So if you start at zero for Prudhoe Bay, you add 787. The new baseline for the Prudhoe Bay satellites, you don't see it in cumulative there, but it starts at 787 and then increases that extra 6,120. So that data point right there is around, I'm just going to round here, 6,800 barrels of oil, and then, decrease 500, decrease 6,400. So that's how you get back to zero. Okay.
And the negative 9,573 is the difference between FY21 and FY22. The chart right above it.
Yes.
So they go together. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pelletier, as you look at what's going on, the GMT2 field that has come online was forecasted to be, or at least we thought was going to be around 7,000 barrels per day that was going to be coming off there. Is that pretty much on track?
Senator Olson, through the chair, yes, remember these, so this data is cut off at June 30th of 2022. GMT2 is performing at expectations.
And Mr. Chairman, what are the expectations for the coming years? Is it going to increase, decrease, stay the same, or can you just give us a general idea of what we can anticipate?
Senator Olson, again, through the chair. I think the way we have this forecast right now is we had an expectation going into it. There's very little production history for us to change anything with the GMT2 pad right now. Mm-hmm. And so the project forecast effectively that we had last year, I don't want to say we mirrored it this year. We updated it with the actual data that we've seen. But since the production performance has been consistent with our expectations, for the next 10 years of the forecast, we left that consistent with years previous.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions before we go to slide 5? Okay, go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Chair. So in this chart, we're going to look at the fiscal year 2022 as forecasted by the DNR in fall of 2021. So how did we do in this process? Again, with the same thing, I'll hit some of the bullet points and then talk to the chart, if that's okay. So what we're looking for here, is we're looking to come within a production range, so a high and a low. It's very hard to hit an actual forecast. We would like to be able to do that, but it's a very, very challenging thing to do in the industry. What I will say for that last second bullet point that we have is the DNR mean forecast was 2% higher than the actual fiscal year 2022 production. And now I'm going to switch over to the chart just to orient everyone to what we have over here. So, again, the axis should be the same here as it was on the previous slide, fiscal year annual average daily oil production from 0 to 600,000 barrels per day on the y-axis. And then you'll see some hashed blue bars, and what those bars are what we call, again, the Department of Revenue, Revenue Sources Book, high forecast in the Department of Revenue Sources Book, low forecast. And again, we're looking for a forecast or for actual production to be within that. Again, we would like it to be on the RSB, or the Revenue Sources Book, official forecast. It's very challenging to do. What you can see last year, the range from the high to the low was about 524,000 barrels a day on the high to just under 450,000 barrels per day on the low. The official forecast for last year was just under 487,000 barrels of oil per day. But actual production came in, again, as we previously stated on the previous slide, at 476,490 barrels of oil per day. As part of this, we also get confidential information from our operators, which we roll up. So all of the operators on the North Slope that actually are making oil out of their facilities right now do provide us a forecast, and we'll share what that aggregation is as well in the forecast. For last year, the operators, if you take what they gave us, would have said that we would have thought the Alaska North Slope would have made just under 500,000 barrels of oil per day. So both forecasts were within the range, but neither were an exact match.
Any other questions? Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to quote my chair and say, if you could put an asterisk on the bottom of these slides on the acronyms for ESG, for those at home that don't know what environmental social governance is, we at the table do, but those that are watching these slides at home might not, Mr. Chairman.
I can assure you a lot of people have never heard of it.
And, they're going to have a question. What's why? Why?
Okay. Next slide, please.
So for the fiscal year 2022, we're now transitioning down to the Cook Inlet Basin. So this is just highlights again from fiscal year 2022 versus fiscal year 2021. We expect all fields to, same as on the North Slope, expect to see a year-on-year production decline. Compared to the fiscal year 2021, Cook Inlet production decreased by roughly 11%, or 1,200 barrels of oil per day. Just a reminder as well that the Cook Inlet Basin, while not a large production basin compared to the North Slope, is very important for the state. Oil from the Cook Inlet Basin is critical to the supply of in-state refineries. I'm going to switch over, just like I did on the previous slide, now as well to the charts. The AXI labels are the same. The scales are different. So you can see on the top chart here for Cook Inlet daily production, fiscal year 2016 through 2022, your scale is now from 0 to 20,000 barrels of oil per day. You do have the highest oil production year for the Cook Inlet was in fiscal year 2016, declining through time. The most recent fiscal year 2022, total oil production was 9,400 barrels of oil per day, roughly. As far as the increases and decreases, instead of going through each field individually on this one, I'm going to change tack a little bit. The majority of the fields saw what I would call natural reservoir decline. So what we wanted to highlight here were, with the three bullet points, was the large decreases and the increases that were outside of that realm. So I'm going to start with the decreases on what we have is the middle ground shoal. You'll see it in the production changes across Cook Inlet assets in the middle, the orange that goes down to 928. I couldn't get the word shoal on that the figure, so please forgive me for that. It just says middle ground dot, dot, dot. That production change year on year was because the field was taken offline due to a fuel gas pipeline leak discovered in April of 2021, and production is currently suspended. So it's a relatively large production decrease, but it's because the facility is offline for integrity reasons. The two increases to highlight on this slide are around the Beaver Creek. So that's the very first field that we have listed here, and that was some really good rate adding well work. So, good job for the operator to get additional oil out of that field. The last two were for the Readout Shoal and West MacArthur River fields for increases, and those were brought back online in September and October of 2021 after being shut in May of 2020 for economic reasons.
Complete the slide?
Yes.
Okay. So could you touch on gas in Cook Inlet? I assume that these charts are just oil?
Yes, sir. Thank you for clarifying that. These are just oil.
Okay. So maybe the department could start thinking about a presentation coming forward on the gas field in Cook Inlet. I would assume resource would be interested in that. And then we'll be having some discussions here dealing with energy for the state, and that's a huge energy source for heater homes, run our communities in and around Anchorage. So if the your department could start thinking about how you're going to put the gas, some of the history and where we're at and where we're going in Cook Inlet together would be appreciated. And we'll get with you when the committee's getting close to having that discussion. But I'm pretty sure it's going to happen. Yes?
For the record, I'm Derek Nottingham, the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. Senator Stedman, Chair Stedman, I just wanted to point out that the DNR, our Division of Oil and Gas, has recently completed a production forecast for the Cook Inlet gas that we would enjoy sharing with you at any point it's convenient for the committee.
Okay, we'll get with our resources committee chairs and figure out how we're going to handle that. But it is of interest to the legislature. So, okay, go ahead and continue.
For the record, Travis Peltier. Thank you, Senator Seddon. So this next slide is a status update of key future projects for the North Slope. The previous few slides talked about fiscal year actuals. This is going to be laying some of the groundwork for, you know, the future production out of the North Slope. What we have here highlighted are just five of the projects. You know, there's actually going to be 17. I'll share the numbers with the rest of the pools later on in the methodology section. But for these five projects that I wanted to highlight, two you've probably heard about in the news quite a bit. So for Pica and Willow, those would be new fields brought online in the North Slope. And the next three are actually either new pads or pad expansions within existing units on the North Slope as well. So that would be the CRU Narwhal CD8, which would be a new pad, Milne Point Raven pad, which would be a new pad, the KRU Nuna Torok, which would be an expanded pad. Within each of these, you know, a number of these were presented last year, so I wanted to give the status for those from last year in brief, talk about the current status, and then, you know, the rate estimates we expect for each. For the Pica project, you know, you might recall last year there was the discussion around, you know, if it was going to get approved for final investment decision or FID. That did come through this year in August of 2022, and project first oil is anticipated in 2026. Peak design rate for phase one, as listed in, we'd say the newspaper, right? 80,000 barrels of oil per day is what's been publicly shared from Operator Santos for that project. For the Willow project, again,
it's up there just for those at home and a reminder for the for all of us. Can you remind us who owns the subsurface of these different projects? Because that has a significant impact on revenue. Although all oil production increases help with the throughput of TAPS, the pipeline, it has a substantial different impact on the Treasury.
Senator Stedman, thank you, yes. So the Pica project is on state land. I think that's what you're asking for. The CRU Narwhal CD8 project, Milne Point Raven Pad, and KRU Nuna Torok would all be on state land. The Willow project would be on federal lands. Does that answer your question fully?
Yes.
Thank you.
And then briefly just touch on why there's a difference, the structure, the tax difference.
Okay. I think I'd have to go to a lifeline for this.
Well, the severance versus royalties. On federal land, we get royalties. There's no state tax, per se, at a high level.
Okay. Do you want to take
that? Correct. Go ahead.
Yeah, Senator Stedman. On state land, the state royalty ranges between 12.5% to 16.67%. So that percentage, it gets applied to the overall either value or volume of the barrels produced off of that land. And so that would be revenue into the state from royalties. Whereas on federal land, that is there's the royalty on federal land is it goes to the federal government, but I do believe there is a portion of that that gets kicked back into the local communities.
So we'll come back to that with more detail later on when we get in the revenue forecast, the breakdown for those watching, but there's a significant difference. So point being, all oil barrels aren't equal to paying our bills. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what you're trying to say is that the impact aid that comes to some of the communities up on the North Slope is the way that the state benefits from the federal royalty that we don't get.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Stedman, Senator Olson. Yes, that is correct.
We'll go into more detail of this when we get into the revenue forecast. I know you guys aren't the revenue guys, but without production, we have no revenue. So go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. For the record, Travis Peltier. I believe I had finished the PICA line, so I'm going to move on to Willow, which is the federal project. Last year, this was remanded by the Alaska District Court with the record of decision. At the time, construction was expected to start in Q1 of 2023, and first oil was expected to be in 2025, 2026. What's happened in the year since, the BLM is awaiting to a record of decision on the supplemental EIS, or the SEIS, that was released this past July of 2022. ConocoPhillips, the operator of the Willow project, cannot make their final investment decision, or FID, prior to that record of decision being made. Whenever that comes out, first oil is expected to be 6 years after FID if the project is approved to move forward. The publicly stated estimates out of this supplemental environmental impact statement have listed it as 180,000 barrels of oil per day peak 2 years after first oil. So that's where that production number comes from, is what was listed in the supplemental EIS documentation. The CRU Narwhal CD8 project. So again, last year we did talk about a Narwhal project at the CRU being within first oil. Technically, we would have moved that off of the projects list into our currently producing categories. However, within that Narwhal project that ConocoPhillips is operating, there was an additional pad, so additional capital investment that needed to be made, and we wanted to carry that with a project with resulting project uncertainties. So we've rebranded that, you know, scope part of it off, and the currently producing in this now project is for CD8 specifically. The January 2022 status, when this was presented last year, you know, that Narwhal project in and of itself was making 1,600 barrels of oil at the time. The vision for CD8, however, is quite large. So again, this would be a new pad. If you take a look at the most recent plan of development submitted by ConocoPhillips for this, the production could commence as early as 2028, pending they get alignment between their stakeholders, permitting, internal studies, and, you know, ultimate approval for the project. The conceptual first oil date, as stated in their 23rd POD, which was in 2021, and the 24th POD submitted in 2022, has been consistent with 2028. We estimate about 3,200 barrels of oil per day could come from this project on state lands. The Milne Point Raven Pad project has been listed in the past, you know, is kind of more within the Milne Point unit plans of development on their 40th POD as future drilling opportunities and undeveloped acreage. This year, Hillcorp operator became more formal, and in November of 2022, they formally applied for approval to construct a new drilling production pad, calling it RPAD, on ADL 025509 within the Milne Point unit. This pad would be very analogous to a recently developed pad called Moose Pad from 2018. We estimate roughly 10,000 barrels of oil per day on state land could come from this project as well. And the last project to talk about is the Kuparuk River Unit Nunatorok project. ConocoPhillips is the operator of this as well. They purchased this asset from Kalis in years past. This has also been talked about in their Kuparuk River Unit plan of development. The most recent one says they're planning to drill additional injector and producers to appraise a future development. So depending on how that works out, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty on this one, but it could also be quite a large producer for the North Slope on state lands.
Okay, we have questions on this slide. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have often looked at sort of peak production design for a field or a project and looked at that as what it's going to produce. Peak production doesn't last that long. How, and when we're trying to look 15 years, 20 years down at the state's fiscal picture, how should we look at these numbers? I don't want to get sort of fascinated by the cashback offer and end up taking a high rate, right? What should we think about for a longer term in terms of production from these wells, and how does that relate to these peak numbers?
Senator Keel, through the chair, thank you for the question. these numbers shown here would be the peak rates coming out of each of the individual fields. I'm going to use the Willow project as an example really quick just to kind of highlight how that peak rate works. You know, you'll see a peak rate, again, as shared in the supplemental EIS documentation, 2 years after first oil production, and then a decline after that. Most of the fields that you see on the north slope of Alaska are supported with either water flooding or other enhanced oil recovery activities. And so you see roughly from your peak rate, you know, anywhere from 5% to 10 or 15%, depending on how well connected the fields are, a decline rate after that. Cumulative volume, of course, varies. We did not put those numbers in this slide, and we could probably see if we're allowed to share that with you at a later date. But kind of take the peak number, I would suggest, and start declining it 10 to 15% as a low-case estimate on volume, knowing that the operators are going to do what they can to optimize that. Decline rates are probably going to be less than that.
Thank you.
Any questions on this slide? Okay, next slide, please.
Okay. Travis Peltier for the record. So this that wraps up kind of where we're at in terms of fiscal year 2022 and some of the big projects we're looking at. We're going to transition now to the production forecasting approach. And just to be clear, you know, I'd mentioned this before, that DNR has been performing, sorry, the Department of Natural Resources has been performing this analysis since 2016. Year on year, we try to be as consistent as possible so that we, you know, the information we're sharing, you know, makes sense to everybody. There's not a lot of changes. However, within a year, you do see room for some improvements. For this year, we did make two minor improvements. One was around project definition. So in years past, you know, we call something currently producing. We had inherently baked in some capital drilling on wells that, you know, would be drilled in the future in that category. This year, we made an effort to explicitly capture those in under development and under evaluation. So our currently producing category, you'll see it called CP in the future, has no future capital drilling in it anymore. Again, referring to the Department of Revenue Revenue Sources book, which actually has the definitions for all three of these production categories, the definitions are now more accurately reflected with the way we did the analysis this year. There was no change in the top line. It's just a shifting from one category to the other. The second major change I alluded to earlier was from a consistency standpoint. So the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Revenue would have slightly different forecasts, specifically for the period, the first 5 months of the year. So that's July through November of the forecast period. You know, for us, in this case, it would have been fiscal year 23. We made sure that we are 100% consistent now with our forecast that we're sharing with you today and with the DOR we'll share with you in a couple of days.
And are you done with this slide?
Yes.
Okay. Can you remind the committee how the interaction between the producers in the fields and your department is dealing with expectations in the future on a calendar basis? Don't they report to you twice a year, and particularly once a year you guys accumulate the data? There's a lot of communication between the two groups. Is that correct?
Senator Sedman, yes. If you don't mind, I'll actually advance to the next slide and chat about that.
Okay.
Is that okay? Okay. So this slide is meant to talk about the various projects and pools along with that DOR, DOG, sorry, the Division of Oil and Gas and the Department of Revenue Engagement with operators. I'll jump straight to the second bullet point to address your question. We do have conversations with operators throughout the year. Within the fall production forecast timeframe, we have a lot of in-depth conversations that are confidential with the operators as well that help us build these forecasts. A lot of that information, like I said, we can't necessarily share because it's held under a confidentiality agreement, but we do use the information to build the production forecast that we share with you. Those meetings are both in-person and written responses. In addition to that fall process, we do an update in the spring where we'll go back to the operators again and ask for updates to any of the information that they provided to us that might be material to our forecasting effort. Along with that, you know, just as part of our normal course of business, you know, we have our plans of development that we receive from the operators typically once a year, but sometimes once every 2 years. And so that's another source of information for us for the production forecasting effort. And those plans of development are typically really, the information that is typically public that we draw and share from in here. So there is a confidential aspect to those as well. And we will use all the information available to us to come up with the best forecast possible. In terms of the projects and pools that we use to create the production forecast, we use all of the publicly available pools from the AOGCC data. Within the Alaska North Slope, we actually lump all the pools of the Cook Inlet into a single basin. So if you think of Cook Inlet oil production as a single basin, again, not gas related, in the Alaska North Slope, there's 37 individual pools that we performed decline curve analysis on that we're producing as of June 30th of 2022. In addition to the currently producing pools that, you know, we do decline curve analysis on, we also put 17 projects, five of which we had previously highlighted on a previous slide with Pikka and Willow as a headline too. We include under development and under evaluation. And that's where we use a lot of confidential information from operators to help build our forecasts. These projects are adjusted for risk, for contribution, chance of occurrence, and start date. So the ultimate forecasts that we create do not necessarily reflect what the operators provide to us. We use our own view to create what the ultimate forecast is. And the last bullet point was around the minor modifications, which I've already addressed.
Next slide, then.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about production categorizations and definitions. You've heard me verbally refer to it. I think this is the first slide with the acronyms for current production, or CP, under development, or UD, and under evaluation, or UE. So ongoing and current production is under the current production category. You know, for our decline curve analysis for this, we have to take a look at well and facility uptime, operator spending, so how much are they making, or how much investment are they making to maintain that base production, and then how has the reservoir management changed from year to year to get a good sense of if we expect a higher production decline rates or less production decline rates throughout the fields that are in this categorization. Future projects, there's two major contributors to this. So the major 17 projects that we talked about, which I'll cover in the last bullet, and then one we haven't hit on yet, which is around infill drilling. So within our existing units, there is continued drilling activity, so additional CapEx, additional investment, where we put new wells into existing fields, and those contributions from the new wells also come in under development and under evaluation. The under development is all within the next 12 months. Under evaluation is 12 months to the 120th month of the forecast. So that's how we split that up, and you'll see that on a chart in the future. For all of these, we do have uncertainty. So for the rate contribution, we always have an uncertainty on future well performance. You know, we can't guarantee exactly how wells are going to work out over the next 10 years. We have to bound that, right, with a high and a low and running sensitivities on that. In addition to that, total well count also plays a large factor in this. So project scope, drilling scope also plays a contributing factor into our high and low parts of our forecast. For other major projects, again, such as Pikka and Willow, which are not currently producing and don't have infill drilling opportunities, there is uncertainty around project startup and timing. So we also make sure to include additional risking into our production profiles for when these projects might actually start up. On top of that, we do build in a commerciality risk, so taking a look at any sort of economic hurdles that might have to get overcome for a project to progress.
Question from Senator Hoffman and Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peltier, you said that we're going to get in a future slide what's happening in CapEx. Are you also going to give numbers as to increases or decreases on CapEx in the past and projected in the future? Because I think that probably is a single indicator of what we as people making public policy would look for in the possible projection of where the future of development is going on the North Slope.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, sorry if I misspoke. We will not be sharing any CapEx or capital expenditure information in this slide. We'll just be sharing the production that we expect from future capital investment.
If that's the case, I would request that you provide my office with that information so at least I have an idea of what's happening on the slope, with CapEx. That has been a major discussion for the last decade of where we're going and the public policy that we set and has been taken over in some respects by petitions to the voters. So I would be very interested in getting that information, because I think it is critical to what we as public policymakers can expect on what's happening at the North Slope. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If you could help us with that and just, you know, send the response back to the chairman's office and we'll distribute it, make sure everybody has it. And when you put that data together on the CapEx, delineate deductible and non-deductible historically. Some of the CapEx costs are non-deductible for our severance. So that'll give us a history. Although they have it in the revenue source book, it'd be nice to put just a little document together for us. And then whatever you can share with us coming in the future is very handy to the committee, because we do watch that, as Senator Hoffman said. Senator Bishop.
Good.
Good. Okay. And, okay, we'll go on to the next slide.
All right. For the record, Travis Peltier, yes. All right, so this next slide is around the major projects, and just this is a map of where they are on the North Slope. Again, these are the under evaluation, under development projects for the fall of 2022. None of these projects were online as of, again, June 30th of 2022, and the risk associated with these projects is higher than those what we would call the current producing fields or producing areas. Places like Prudhoe Bay, you know, where your production risk is relatively low year on year compared to a new development with no production history. These fields all listed, and we can go through the list here in a minute, are all known discoveries with identifiable operators, and they all do require major investments over the next 10-year time frame within the production forecast period. So from west to east, if you'd like me to go through the various projects, you can see in the top left corner of the map there, you have Smith Bay, far top left corner, and then we actually transition pretty quickly over to the Willow development, which is on federal lands, highlighted in red there for the map purposes, showing the distinction between state and federal lands. The state lands were colored in green. The Umiat development is actually south of Willow, so directly south, you'll see that is also on federal lands there. And then we go over to Narwhal, CERU Narwhal CD8 for this map. We just called it Narwhal on the map where the green triangle was. There's a lot of projects in that area, so having all the written words out got very complex. We just called it Narwhal for simplicity. Then we have the Horseshoe Stirrup, Pika unit, and Kwaka Mitkak unit, all in that same area, just to the east of the Alpine area. Then you'll see the Mustang just below the Kwaka Mitkak. Nunatoruk within the Kaparik River unit as well is a little bit farther to the east. And then you'll see we're going over now towards the Milne Point Raven Pad in Ugnew development, are right next to each other. South of them, you have Theta West, Alcade, and Talitha, those three developments down there. And then going back to federal properties, we have the Liberty unit just to the west of Point Thompson, and then two projects within the Point Thompson unit itself, Point Thompson unit expansion, so not just the initial production system, and then a sourdough project, so which is operated by a different operator, Jade Energy. That's why you have the map call out there, Jade, on there, since it's not operated by Hillcorp.
Okay, questions on this map? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peltier, as you look at the map there, the Smith Bay development, you know, caught a lot of people by, were happy, and partly because it was so close to Barrow and all those other promising things that we like to see done by Kalis, and they were the ones that did the discovery, and then Kalis left the state. Do you have an update on what is going on with the development related to Smith Bay and some of the interests that might be out there?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I think a lot of that information might be confidential, so I have to get back to you on what I can and can't share specifically about that. Director Nottingham, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Yes, Senator Olson, through the chair, I can just generally say that the operator is actively looking at options to explore and delineate the reservoir further.
Including production.
If you can get back to the committee on that, and we can always have a conversation with the operator, they might tell us more than what you can allow to tell us. Senator Bishop.
I might be off base, but isn't that information only embargoed for 10 years?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I will have to get back to you on
that. Okay, thank you.
And if you can get back to us on the, and then if it's non-embargoed information, you can add it. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peltier, I guess you talked about some of these being higher risk of not coming on and some maybe less risky that way. Can you tell us a little bit about how you put that risk into your forecast? I mean, I'm looking at some of these sort of greenfield things pretty far from infrastructure. I'm also looking at Liberty, which 20 years ago I leaned on that windowsill and heard it was coming soon.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, I can talk a little bit about that. So all of these projects, you know, they all have what I would call uncertainty, right? Call it risk if you'd like. The uncertainty, again, we kind of discussed on a previous slide. There's really a couple of major components to it. One is the chance of occurrence of the project actually coming on, right? 0 to 100%. The project start date, when do we actually think it will occur? And then while we feed a base production rate for each project, we also have a risk factor associated with that about will that project actually achieve the target rate we think it will. So those are the three major components. The way we as a group kind of put this together is not everybody in the room has the same information when we do this information, right? It's not just one person doing it. We actually get a group of about 24 people who are aware of various aspects of the project together in a room to kind of discuss and hash out these various pieces of uncertainty on the various projects. So like a Liberty project, since you showed that one as an example, you know, we as a group gave that one a relatively perhaps low chance of occurrence to something that we, you know, think had maybe a higher chance of occurrence. And I'm just going to say Milne Point Raven Pad because it's within an existing unit next to existing infrastructure with a known resource base, if that makes sense. So the way it kind of works in aggregate, you know, we don't take a look at the individual results for the forecast. I mean, we do. But what we care about is the aggregation of all of these risks across all of these projects for that under evaluation category. And so the higher risk projects and the lower risk projects, they all have risk. Even the low risk projects don't always work out as you expect. And some of the high risk projects work out as good or better than you expect. So in aggregate across all 17 of these, that's really the component of the production forecast we want to make sure has integrity throughout this process, if that makes sense. We don't want to take a look at each individual one and pick on them. We use the same process for all of them and then aggregate those results together.
Okay.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the same process for all of them, I guess I don't have a solid sense of what that is. The loudest engineer in the room wins? I'm joking, of course.
Senator Keel, through the chair, for the record, Travis Peltier. No, we actually, we don't have just engineers in the room. It's engineers, geoscientists, folks in permitting, folks in our commercial analyst group. And we all get one vote, so it's very democratic. There's roughly 24 people in the room, so we all get roughly, 4% of our voice gets taken into account in the final results. So.
Okay. Next slide.
All right, we're going to transition on now to the production forecast results themselves. So I'm going to discuss the chart here to orient us that. So that's front and center, and then I'll talk about the bullets at the end of that. So what we have here is the fall 2022 North Slope production forecast. So this does not have, you know, the Cook Inlet in it. This is just Alaska's North Slope. The chart, you know, the axis is similar to our previous axis we've had on other slides, the fiscal year annual average daily oil production. This scale I did change. You know, it goes from 0 to 1 million barrels a day now, so just be aware of that change. And we have four components to it. So we have the high forecast case, as it's titled, so which you'll see in the revenue sources book as the high forecast case. That will be reflected in the revenue sources book when you eventually see that from the Department of Revenue. You have that low case as well, same thing, that will be the Department of Revenue, Revenue Sources Book, Low Forecast Case, which we provide, you know, the Department of Natural Resources provides that to the Department of Revenue. And then you have the two middle cases that we do spend a lot of time trying to make sure we get right. The official forecast case, that's what the Department of Natural Resources comes up with, and that's, again, the same case you'll see in the Revenue Sources Book for this year. And then that summation of what the operator forecast they gave to us confidentially when we roll all of them up across the North Slope, what that aggregation looks like over the next 10 years. One thing to note between the official forecast that we, the Department of Natural Resources, put out versus what the operator forecast has, and this will be the commentary just to the right of the chart, that total official forecast includes future projects. And by definition, you know, when we get information from the operators, we're not asking for operators that don't have currently producing projects. So you start to see a break around 2027, and you can argue it maybe even happens in 2026, that there is future projects in the official forecast that are not in the operator's forecast. That's why you see that disparity start to grow as our projects begin to take a very large component of that future production forecast. For the short term, for the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, for our forecast for fiscal year of 2023, our annualized average daily state production is 501,000 barrels of oil per day, which from the North Slope is 492,000 barrels of oil per day. The range on that, you know, fiscal year 2023 for the North Slope is on the low end to the high end, 448,000 to 535,000. Senator Stedman, if I may, I realize they used nomenclature on here that might not be familiar with some folks on the line where you see the M. I think a lot of people might consider that millions of barrels of oil per day. This is unfortunate industry lingo, so again, my apologies for not correcting this and not catching it sooner. We in the industry would consider that 1,000. So single M is 1,000, and it'd take 2 M to make a million.
So. Any questions on this slide? Just a brief comment and a reminder, especially for those that were sitting here a little over a decade ago, we had forecasts of oil production that we're in a parabolic curve and it's going to, with a flat tail, is going to go on for several decades. So that prediction was pretty much right on point. And that assumes that the industry and the state will do nothing to, let me rephrase that. It assumes that the industry and the state will do everything it can to extend the life of the field, not just let the natural decay happen. And I think that's pretty much what goes on around the globe. So the forecast that we had well over a decade ago was pretty much right on top of where we're at. So that's good as far as that goes. It would be nice, obviously, to get Willow and a few other of these bigger projects rolling forward to increase their production and a little bit more. But anyway, I just thought I'd make that note. This is not new information. It's good information. Because clearly, if we weren't tracking, there'd be something up. We'd have to dive into it. With that, we'll go on to the next slide, please.
Senator Stedman, for the record, this is Travis Peltier. I just wanted to hit the last bullet point on the production forecast itself, which is around there's certain assumptions we have to make to have this production forecast, you know, be valid. And they can change, right, over the course of the forecast. Again, we start this process with data at the end of June 30th of 2022. Business is very dynamic, so assumptions do change in the fullness of time. That's why we do a spring forecast update with, you know, changes to any information we might see. So we'll do again an update in the spring, and then, you know, this process again next fall. So I just wanted to make sure we hit that these forecasts do assume that the operator's plans and other project drivers remain unchanged through the forecast period. This is the second to last technical slide here. We have the Alaska statewide oil production forecast, the expected case and categories of production. So we have on here are, again, two charts. I'm going to just kind of highlight the chart on the left and then go to the chart on the right just because I think it's different from last year. So the 2022 production forecast, this is just looking at that official forecast case now broken out by various production categories. Again, the y-axis is the same. You have the fiscal year annual average daily oil production in terms of barrels of oil per day. ranging from 0 to 700,000 barrels of oil per day on your y-axis. Again, this is, you know, mostly bouncing between 5 and 600,000 on the top line if you take a look at it. You can see the currently producing fields there in blue, the next 12 months of development drilling in orange, and then that under evaluation, which does include future infill drilling in current fields combined with the future projects there in the gray wedge. You'll see the currently producing fields, they do decline through time. That's what you expect to get off of, you know, no future capital investment, but, you know, making sure the facilities are continuing to run. That's why continued investment in the oil field is very important. What we have there then for the orange, again, is the future 12 months, next 12 months of drilling that we expect on the North Slope. And then you'll start to see on the, you know, relatively flat production around 500,000 barrels of oil per day, and then an increase starting in 2028 on the gray wedge. For this, I'm going to transition to the chart on the right now. Senator Stedman's left, for those watching. On the axes here, I left them the same, so fiscal year annual average daily oil production in terms of barrels of oil per day. The fiscal year axis is also the same, and you only see the under evaluation category here. And you start to see production growth ramping up into as we get towards, you know, the mid 20 and late 2020s, and then another small peak there right at the end of the forecast period in 2032. And this has to do with how we do our uncertainty analysis on our future projects. Again, you maybe see from the first slide, someone might be asking, you know, I saw you said Pica was going to make, you know, FID phase one 80,000 barrels a day in 2020. I think the number was 2026 for the year. Why don't I see just a straight jump? And it has to do with how we do our risking for project chance of occurrence and project startup date. And what ends up happening is those, you know, what we might consider big jumps get spread out through the fullness of time based off of the individual votes that people during the process share when they think the project might actually start up, if that makes sense. So instead of seeing an individual bump for a big project starting up, you'll see a slowly increasing wedge through time, which is why the gray chart looks the way it does. Does that make sense?
Any other questions? Just a quick one. So we have changing administrations in Washington every few years. How do you deal with your risk-adjusting analysis when you go from one administration to another one? And as a current example would be the previous administration that was very helpful to the state of Alaska moving our resource extraction industry forward versus what appears to be a less enthusiastic current administration compared to the last one. How do you adjust that, or do you even take that politics into account?
For the record, Travis Peltier, Chair Stedman. We do it with two components of our risking. So we have, again, the chance of occurrence. Is this project actually going to work, come on within the next 10 years? It's literally every participant gets a vote, right, as we discussed earlier, from a 0 to 100% chance of occurrence. And then the other one is with project start date. So do we think it's going to come on when the operator shared with us? Do we think it's going to come on based off of things we've read in the news? You know, what's our view across our various departments about these projects coming on? And so those are the two major components of uncertainty that feed into, you know, what I would call the uncertainty for projects like on the federal side, like with Willow specifically. So we're not just turning it on or off. It gets, that production profile does get spread out through time based off of how the group decides it should look from their own perspective.
So the short answer is yes, you do balance that out every year, readjust it.
Yes.
Depending on current conditions.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions before we jump to the last slide? Next slide, the one you've been looking for all morning.
Senator Stedman, thank you for that. This is the fall 2022 production forecast summary. So the very last technical slide that we have here, you know, the DNR's, the Department of Natural Resources forecast continues to use the best information that we have available to us across both the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Revenue to generate the production outlook for all the oil fields within the state. The focus is generating an accurate near-term and realistic long-term forecast, balancing both of those out. Fall of 2022 view forecast, it's a static view on production. So I think I maybe talked about this previously. You know, forecasts do need to get updated, but this fall 2022 forecast is static based off the assumptions we had at the time. We will update this again in the fall and the spring, to incorporate the latest information that we have, the latest operator plans, and the state's official price outlook, which also plays a component in this forecast. For this specific forecast for the fall of 2022, the outlook shows a mean annual production of approximately 500,000 barrels of oil per day across much of the outlook period. And that's, again, based off of the current snapshot of operators' plans that we had, you know, this most previous fall. Production from projects under evaluation does reflect uncertainty in the operators' plans. What we have seen is a more return to investment from pre-pandemic activity levels, which is good. Specific projects uncertainties and project timing and scope risks, however, still remain. And those will always play a component in our production forecast. So
that's it?
For this slide, yeah. I'm just curious.
That'd be the end. That's the last slide I got, other than the thank you slide.
Well, yeah, that's right. So, and I did want to say thank you. You know, the team is very excited to bring this to you, the Senate Finance Committee, to share. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of people to put this together every year. And so we just want to say thank you for giving us the opportunity to share it with you today. And this is the production forecasting team. And I'd maybe thank the members on the line as well who called in, who never actually called on for Lifelines. But Chilinda Weerasinghe, Linda Liu, John Burdick, Sean Peterson, Johnny Meza, and myself were the core leads on this. But thank you for the opportunity.
And thank you for coming before the community. And thank all your support staff. I know it's a group effort. And, you know, we get it done in an hour and a half here, but there's a substantially more than an hour and a half of preparation by far. So this will conclude the meeting today. We will convene. The next meeting is Friday. And we're going to have the revenue forecast from the Department of Revenue. And for those that are watching at home, the price of oil is much more sensitive to our revenue than the production variables as they change. But so we have to put them both together to get our estimates. So the meeting Friday will be the next step in taking a look at our revenue, and then the following week we'll proceed into presentations on the budget. With that, thanks everybody for coming this morning. We are adjourned at 10:27. We are adjourned.